Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. And number five, we have Congress overriding Obama's veto of the JASTA bill, which will allow Americans to sue Saudi Arabia for some of its nationals' complicity in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Talk about democracy in action, guys, and I rarely ever say that, let alone about the U.S. Here you have Obama vetoing JASTA, officially known as the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorist Acts bill, because of concerns that it would open up the U.S. to other lawsuits all across the world. Which is technically true, because lawfare can theoretically go both ways, especially in an increasingly multipolar world. But then Congress shamed the president by overriding his veto and passing it anyway, obviously with an eye on the populist vote for the congressman facing re-election this November. Plus, it just makes sense. I mean, most of the 9/11 terrorists were from Saudi Arabia, and while that in and of itself isn't necessarily anything legally damning, the later revelations that they may have received some support from Saudi diplomats and government-connected individuals certainly is. Or at least, it's good enough to go to court and have a judge decide what to do with it. The Saudis had a crazy reaction to this development and vowed that there will be consequences, indirectly hinting at the threats and pullout of funds and investments and the selling off of government debt that was floated around over the summer as an intimidation measure against the U.S. government. Since JASTA is now law, we'll see how much of this was just bluff and bluster, and how much they really meant. In terms of the big picture, this conforms with what I analyzed on Context Countdown a few weeks ago, when I spoke about the two back-to-back high-profile anti-Wahhabi publications in the New York Times and Politico, by the Iranian foreign minister and the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and Iraq, respectively. The larger trend that we see at play is that the U.S.-Saudi relationship has reversed, and that it's now the U.S. enforcing its will and pressure on the Saudis, and not the opposite like it had previously been. Washington's deep state strategist, those in the permanent military, intelligence, and diplomatic bureaucracies who ensure foreign policy continuity during presidential transitions, are split on whether to retain the Saudi alliance or move towards a groundbreaking new sort of partnership with Iran. It looks like the pro-Iran faction is winning right now, and even if they weren't beforehand, the Saudis' reaction to JASTA will make this a self-fulfilling prophecy in any case, unwittingly turning the Saudis' worst nightmare into a reality. In the middle of this progressively unfolding grand realignment in the Mideast, like I also spoke about before on my program a few weeks ago, we will probably see China, and perhaps even Russia to various extents and in certain spheres, vying with the U.S. for influence in Saudi Arabia and complicating the Gordian knot of regional geopolitics even more than it already is. And guys, that's why JASTA is important. Not just because it could bring justice to some American victims, but because it made the grand realignment irreversible. The next one up is the bombshell report proving that the Pentagon paid over $500 million for the production of fake terrorist propaganda. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism, a UK-based nonprofit, lived up to its name by releasing what might be one of the media industry's most important reports ever. The outlet proved that the Pentagon began working with the PR firm Bell Pottinger shortly after the U.S. launched the war on Iraq in 2003, and since then, it spent over $500 million on this scheme, which was signed off at the highest levels by both the White House and General David Petraeus. What they allegedly intended to do was disseminate this fake propaganda and seed it with online geo-tracking information to see who's watching and sharing the stuff, in order to get an idea of where these terrorist networks are and how they're organized. In principle, this sounds fine, but in reality, we've now opened up a Pandora's box beyond anything that anyone could have ever thought would have been publicly known. Now that it's proven that the U.S. invested over $500 million in fake terrorist propaganda for over a decade, this calls into question every single thing that was ever publicly released in the Western mainstream media and attributed to the said terrorist. What about Bin Laden's numerous audio recordings and sporadic video appearances? How about Daesh's infamous beheadings? Do a quick search in alternative media and you'll find plenty of convincing evidence that many, if not all, of those were fakes, with some of Daesh's videos obviously being recorded in front of green screens. Conspiracy? No, not at all. and nobody could ever use that label to discredit anyone else who raises these points because the Bureau of Investigative Journalism's historic report raises enough plausible doubt about each and every one of those pieces of terrorist propaganda that, honestly, nobody really knows any longer where fact begins and fiction ends. The U.S.'s Information Operations Task Force and Joint Psychological Operations Task Force both participated in this big game of smoke and mirrors. So really, I hate to sound cliched, but the government was, quote-unquote, in on it. Literally. So let's take it a step further then, shall we? Why stop at terrorist propaganda? I mean, if they're going as far as to manufacture Salafist propaganda, which obviously seemed real to the millions of followers that probably watched it, why wouldn't they do the same thing in trying to frame Russia? Think about all those fake reports in Western think tanks about how Russia supposedly sides with neo-Nazi groups and all this other junk. Where do you think that came from? A clumsy Kremlin that just can't help but get caught over and over again, cavorting with the worst scum in Europe? Or the White House and Pentagon? Well, we just have to wait for another Bureau of Investigative Journalism report to conclusively prove what many people already suspect, don't we? Third on our countdown is the $100 million drone base that the U.S. is secretly constructing in northern Niger, and the reason why the Pentagon wants such a huge facility in the proverbial middle of nowhere. Investigative journalist and AFRICOM expert Nick Terse released yet another of his brilliant articles about Africa earlier this week on The Intercept, and this time he put the global spotlight on the U.S.'s secret drone base in Niger. At a cost of over $100 million, this isn't just your run-of-the-mill airfield and hangar, but a state-of-the-art facility that's meant to remain there for quite a while. But why, you might be wondering. Niger, if any of you guys even know where it is a sparsely populated landlocked country right in the middle of the Sahara Desert. So most people probably don't understand why the U.S. would invest such time, money, and military resources into building a drone base all the way out there. The reason, however, is strategic foresight and geopolitics. Agadez, the windswept Saharan town where this prospective base would be located, is also in close proximity to the uranium deposits, on which about a third of France's total energy production depends. This is because around three-quarters of France's electricity is produced by nuclear energy, and the country imports about 40% of its uranium from Niger. So the U.S. drone base will both help secure France's deposits, but also in a sense put pressure on Paris. In the future, if it ever steps out of line and goes rogue by moving too close to the multipolar world. On a more local, immediate level, the UN's Population Prospects 2015 report startlingly says that Niger, where a woman averages about 7 children in a lifetime, is the fastest growing country in the world, and it'll surge from its present 19 million people to 72 million by mid-century and 209 million by 2100. And since it's already one of the poorest and most underdeveloped countries in the world, it'll probably fall into failed state status and become an incubator for West African terrorist groups. Africa's most populous country of Nigeria is located right to the south of Niger, and Boko Haram has already proven itself to be a formidable foe there. Further west in the desert sands lies Mali, two-thirds of which was taken over by Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb from mid-2012 until the beginning of 2013. And of course, there's the failed state of Libya to the northeast, destroyed by the US and NATO in 2011. And then, don't forget that Algeria's barren southeastern borderland lies to the northwest, and the US is always trying to gain some leverage on this resistant country as well. So, all these factors explain why building a $100 million drone base in the proverbial middle of nowhere is actually a very strategic and foresighted decision. But let's also not forget the theory of hybrid war, which says that the U.S. wants to disrupt, control, or influence multipolar transnational connective infrastructure projects. And Niger is smack dab in the middle of Trans-African Highway 5, which connects with number 6 in trying to streamline a Dakar to Djibouti transcontinental trading route, the eastern half of which China wants to modernize into a railroad, with Beijing already taking steps to do this in the west between Dakar and Bamako. I'll be writing about this at length in a future article and drawing it all out on a map. But the bigger picture is what I call the Sahelian-Saharan Silk Road. And that, guys, not terrorism, is why the U.S. wants such a huge military footprint in Niger, which, not coincidentally, lies midway along this future new Silk Road. Our runner-up is how the Colombian people surprised the entire world by narrowly voting against the peace treaty with FARC and throwing the years-long reconciliation process into jeopardy. This story will go down in history as a perfect example of media and political arrogance when the politicians, information elite, and naive well-wishers jumped the gun, counted their chickens before they hatched, and were taught an unforgettable lesson by the Colombian people. I don't want to take sides in all this, but what I do want to say is that peace is always good, and it's something that we should always work for. But no outside actor should dictate the terms and conditions for peace in a half-century-long civil war. This needs to be domestically led, domestically driven, and domestically resolved. But what we saw is that the international negotiating process in Cuba over the past couple of years, despite the involvement of domestic Colombian participants from the government and FARC, was so secretive and removed from the eyes of the general masses that regular Colombians were understandably very distrustful of it. And former President Uribe, who's one of Colombia's most stalwart hardliners against the group, actively campaigned against this peace agreement by saying that it conceded way too much to FARC and was unfair to the Colombian people who suffered at the hands of a group whose national popularity barely ever breaks 10%. Now, like I said, I'm not taking sides here, but the facts are the facts, no matter how ideologically uncomfortable they may be. And if we want to get down to the bottom of what happened here, we need to confront them head on. So the final step in this peace process was for the Colombian people to vote on it in a referendum, though in a jaw-droppingly display of arrogance, the president signed the document 1 week before the vote was even held, and international dignitaries were wildly and prematurely celebrating the end of the infamous war. But there's a problem, of course. The people hadn't even voted for it yet, and this undoubtedly incensed many of them, who felt that they were being dictated what to do in the most condescending way possible. Furthermore, some details about the agreement were upsetting to many Colombians, such as the fact that most of FARC's members would essentially get a slap on the wrist for admitting to war crimes, and could even run for office, with a handful of them guaranteed political seats for a certain length of time. Even if this was theoretically the best deal possible, it was executed with such clumsiness and blatant disregard for the concerns of average Colombians that in hindsight, it's not hard to see why self-respecting and patriotic citizens would reject this patronizing peace deal. The lesson learned? Don't pop the champagne until after the people have spoken. At our top spot, we've got the simmering tensions between the U.S. and Russia over Syria and the polar opposite course of action that each side seems committed to in the near future. Guys, everything seems to have spiraled out of control in the past couple of weeks, especially after the Pentagon bombed the Syrian Arab Army in Deir ez-Zor during the middle of the so-called ceasefire, which I just wrote an article about for Katihan if you're interested in some deeper analysis on that. But now, the US and Russia are at their worst point ever, and I mean ever. It hasn't ever been this bad or dangerous, even during the old Cold War. The U.S. cut off conflict resolution contact with Russia and only retains the absolute minimum of communication about Syria when it comes to avoiding overflight incidents over Syrian airspace. Russian diplomats have finally been let loose from their previous restraints and are now openly accusing the U.S. of siding with terrorists, just as it has always been all along, but which wasn't ever directly said out of long-term and pragmatic diplomatic considerations in trying to reach a negotiated settlement. Now, though, Russian ambassador to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, said that peace was possible with the ceasefire deal, but that it doesn't look like it'll be restored anytime soon, even going as far as to accuse the US of a deal with the devil for not targeting al-Nusra, and thus indirectly using them as a strategic on-the-ground asset for regime change in Syria. Lavrov also chimed in by questioning whether the US's infamous Plan B for Syria was to depend on terrorist groups for toppling Assad, which, if you ask me, was Plan A, B, C, and everything else that the U.S. has up its sleeve there. On the one hand, it's refreshing to see Russian diplomats condemning the U.S. with such harsh and factually true language like that which countless online activists and analysts have used over the years. But on the other, it signifies that Russia and the U.S. are so far at odds with one another that it would take a miracle for them to get back on the same page and restart the peace process, let alone trust one another enough to do so. The U.S.'s new plans amount to arming the moderate rebels, otherwise known as terrorists, with anti-air manpads and other strategic and heavy armaments by using its Gulf partners as intermediaries, while Russia seems to have given its military free rein in dealing with the terrorists as they should be treated, which is through a sustained bombing campaign that finishes the job and doesn't stop until the threat is unequivocally eliminated. So what this means for Syria is that the war-torn country is in for yet another sudden spike in conflict escalation, one which will return parts of the state to total war, as the two great powers pull back their restraints and engage in the most intense proxy war ever, with Russia doubling down behind the Syrian Arab Army and the U.S. digging in its heels and supporting the terrorist. The game changer in all of this, however, might just end up being Turkey, since it has the political will and active ground presence to send more armored units into the theater of war, potentially tipping the scales in either the U.S. or Russia's favor. So guys, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to thank you guys for listening to my program. I sincerely appreciate it, and I hope you guys will tune in again next week. If you like what you heard, please share it on social media too. Talk to you later. Bye.